Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Friday, March 13th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll hear a fitting mudroom story for Friday the 13th. Katie Brugman will be here with the details on Saturday's Sham Jam at the Canvas. We'll get a preview of this week's Friday Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center on bats. And we'll talk with John DeVore about Red Bull's film at the Rockwell tonight. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on the Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The director of the Lakota Nation Invitational, held in South Dakota each year, says the board is considering moving the event out of Rapid City to Sioux Falls or even Bismarck. The LNI, as it's called, started as a Native basketball tournament in Rapid City in the 1970s. Today, it's grown into a major event with an economic impact measured in the millions. But as Charles Michael Ray reports, tense race relations in Rapid City after an alleged attack on Native children prompted calls for a move.
The Lakota Nation Invitational is among the largest events of the year in Rapid City. It includes various activities, spans multiple days, and brings in students, parents, and fans from schools across the region. But the response to an alleged attack on Native children during a hockey game in Rapid City has prompted some calls to move the LNI. Brian Brewer is a founder and director of the event. Brewer says at a previous meeting, the LNI board voted to stay in Rapid City. But he says that vote wasn't final.
You know, we've been there for 38 years. It is our home. It's in the Black Hills. We've faced many issues there in the past, but we're going to look at everything. We're going to meet with the Rapid City people. And we did schedule an appointment to meet with Sioux Falls people on the 25th, and we will be also talking to Bismarck, North Dakota.
Brewer says any move out of Rapid City could limit the attendance with longer and more expensive travel times. He says the board will weigh all the options and make a final decision during its meeting in April. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
California Indians and scholars of Native American history are gathering today to discuss the canonization of a Catholic priest who established the mission system. Christina Onnested reports.
Was Junipero Serra a religious trailblazer or an imperialist? That's what the conference called California Indians, Canonization of Junipero Serra and Consequences of Colonialism will explore, says Clifford Trafser, a professor of history at UC Riverside, where the conference is taking place.
No one had asked the California Indian people about their feelings about the mission systems.
The mission system that Junipero Serra established decimated the California Indian population and introduced a system of slavery, says Trafser. He says Pope Francis must be misinformed to grant sainthood to a man who initiated such an oppressive church system.
Canonization represents a nod in favor of colonization and the taking over of other people's lands and their resources and forcing them into a labor system that they did not have a choice in.
But not everyone agrees. Trafser says a variety of opinions from California Indians to scholars of the mission system will discuss their positions during the day-long symposium. For National Native News, I'm Christina Onnested in California.
Securing and protecting intellectual property was discussed at the Reservation Economic Summit held this week in Las Vegas. Carlene Hunter is co-founder and CEO of two businesses, including Native American Natural Foods.
We're being exploited right and left, and companies say, oh, we're doing it to honor the Native. No, they're doing it, and they're exploiting our people and taking resources away from Native Americans. You know, we've had this done for over 100 years, and we have to stand up and say, no, not anymore. People need to protect their, property rights. They need to trademark. But also, when you see it being done, stand up and say something. You know, we need to expose people that are ripping off our resources from our communities growing, our businesses growing.
Business leaders say with the rise of competition on the internet and global market, understanding intellectual property is critical. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians. Colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in American Indians 50 and over. For yourself, your family, and our community, get screened. Info at AmericanIndianCancer.org. Supported by the Tribal Telecom and Technology Conference, Weaving Pathways Across the Digital Divide. The annual Tribal Telecom Golf Classic will be held May 4th, 2015 at the Isleta Eagle Golf Course. Info at TribalTelecomConference.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Friday, March 13th, 2015. It's about 6 minutes after the hour. And because it's Friday the 13th, here is a Mudrooms piece that was recorded in April of 2012 that fits the day.
Phoebe Rohrbacher is our third speaker. Phoebe was born and raised in Juneau. Since graduating from college, she's been working with people with developmental disabilities and making art. And here's Phoebe.
Okay. Can you hear me? It's too loud, maybe. Okay. I thought the theme was taking a trip somewhere. I didn't know the theme was transitions, so... I'm going to try to think on my feet. No, just kidding. I knew. Okay. So, transitions, you know, there's lots of kinds, whatever. Yes. Okay. I'm just going to jump into the story. Okay. And you guys can kind of like fill in where's the transition element. Okay. So, I was about 18, maybe 17. It was the summer between high school and college, and I really like to run a lot. So at that time, I was like, "Oh, I need to run. I'm so pent up. I'm an angsty teenager." And so we ate dinner, and I'm like, "Mom and Dad, I need to go running." And they're like, "Phoebe, it's about 7:30 in August. Like, it's not dark yet, but can you just promise us you'll go on the road? Because you shouldn't go in the woods by yourself." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, I promise. Okay, bye." And so I went out on my run. I was running down Douglas Highway, and I was like, "Oh, I'm really bored. I really wish I was in the woods right now." So I decided to go up into some neighborhoods. I was like, maybe that can satiate my need for the forest. So I'm running, and then I came across, I'm like up in this neighborhood called Forest Edge, which I was like, great. I'll be on the edge of the forest. So I see this tiny trail. I'm like, hey, no biggie. There's a little trail, and it goes down into the woods a little bit, but I can still see the neighborhood. So, Mom and Dad, they'll never know. So I was like running, and then soon I was just kind of walking, because there was no trail. It was just bushes and like Devil's Club. But I was like, I can still see that whole neighborhood. So I'm just gonna keep pushing through. So I'm like stepping over giant logs and like pushing through. I'm like, I can hardly see those houses anymore, but I need to figure out how to, and then I'm like, I need to get out of here. Like all of a sudden I was like, oh, wait a minute. I'm in the middle of a gully. Like, what? I'm like in Lawson Creek bed. I was like, how did I get here? Because there's houses back there, there's houses up there, but this is just like straight up forest. I see what they mean when they say Forest Edge. So I'm starting to get nervous all of a sudden. I was like, oh my God, it's 7:30 at night. I'm by myself. I'm in a goddamn forest. And I need to get out of here immediately. So I'm trying to like push through the brush, and I was like, oh, I know, I'll go this way. Looks like there's another trail. Like, what am I thinking? So I'm like, start going that way, and something tells me, no, go that way. So I was like, okay, so I'm going that. I'm like jump like big logs and stepping, and then I'm like, oh, I know, I'll go that way still. And it's like, eh, me go that way. So I was like, okay, go that way. So I, and all of a sudden I'm standing there and I'm like, oh my God, if I died here, no one would ever find my body. I was like, I need to get up here now! Oh my God! So I'm like clamoring, like pushing, like trying to run, but I can't. And then I like stopped. Something's like, go that way. I was like, okay. So I go that way. I look over. Human skull. And I was like, oh, F word. Try and make this radio appropriate. So I'm like, holy S word. Oh, F. Oh, F. And I'm like, Phoebe, calm down. No, it's fine. You're in Douglas. There were miners here. It's cool. It's an old miner. It's skeleton. He was just gold panning in Lawson Creek once. I was like, oh, good. Okay. And then, but like 2 seconds later, I look over again. Like, I'm like, ah! This is spinal cord with cartilage on it. Oh, no. So then I was like, ah, okay, I have to get out of here now. So then I'm like, oh, F word. Like, run. And I like found the side of this gully. And I climbed up and I was wearing running clothes and they were just completely muddy. And I was shaking and I saw this house. And I was like, I need to call the police. So I ran to the house, knock, 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 knock. And this man opens the door, and he's like, he had a glass of wine. And he's like, can I help you? And I was standing there, and I was like, I just found a human body. And he's like, do you want a glass of wine? And like, my first response is like, yes, give me the whole bottle. But then the second, like, I'm like, no, are you crazy? And then I was thinking, oh my God, this is the killer. This is the killer. So then he's like, I'm like, can I use your phone? I need to call the police and turn you in, you murdering bastard. And then, but then I'm like, yeah, I need to use the phone. So he's like, why don't you go wash your hands? I was like, okay, yep. Okay. You know, I'm walking backwards to the bathroom. I'm like, I'm keeping an eye on you, man. And so I call the police. I'm like, oh, hey, I found a skeleton. And they're like, are you sure it wasn't a deer, ma'am? I was like, yeah, I'm sure I'm not an idiot. Thank you. It was a human. Please bring the police. And then I had another phone call to make, and it was to my family. And so I called them, like, oh, hey, Dad, you know, whoops. I was not running on the road. I found a body in the woods. Yep, you were right. Don't run in the woods. Okay, yes, come get me. So anyhow, I guess the police came. They found the body. It turned out it was a man who lived right in the neighborhood. And I guess they'd been looking for his body for months. So it turned out, you know, if you do die in that woods, like, no one ever finds your body unless it's me, like, going on a run. But they'd called off the search. I mean, they'd looked for him for a long time. And I guess that brings me to my... how I'm going to tie it all together is that the idea of transitions is really, I think, kind of, you can drive it home here in Juneau because we're right up against the woods, you know. You feel like you're in such a safe neighborhood, but you just can, like, you know, walk 2 feet down a trail and you end up in, like, the straight-up forest. And so I guess it's, yeah, I guess that's my story. And I hope you enjoy it. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Supporting KTOO today is one of the best and easiest things you can do with 2 minutes of your time. The money you donate will become stories and programs that will continue to keep you entertained and connected to Juneau, to Alaska, and to the rest of our world. All in just 2 minutes. Let's keep the public in public radio. K2 depends on your year-round support. Renew or start your membership today at ktoo.org.
You're listening to A Juneau Afternoon here on Friday, March 13th, 2015. It's about 20 minutes after the hour.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 13th of March, 2015. It's the birthday of Uncle Sam as a cartoon. Made his debut on this day in 1852, a cartoon in the New York Lantern. The name Uncle Sam had been around since about 1810, but this was the first time that someone thought to draw him in human form. Frank Henry Ballou was the artist. It's the birthday of Percival Lowell, born Boston, 1855, studied mathematics and history at Harvard, and was not happy working in the family's textile business, and decided to devote himself to astronomy and to studying Mars. He believed that the canals on Mars offered proof of intelligent life. And so he built his private observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, the Lowell Observatory. It was on this date in 1781 the English astronomer Sir William Herschel discovered the planet Uranus. Other people had seen it, but he was the first one to figure out that it was a planet and not a star. And he could see that it was very far from the sun, farther even than Saturn, the farthest known planet at that time. Over the years, astronomers have discovered 27 moons orbiting the planet, which is named for the Greek god of the sky, Uranus. It's the birthday of Janet Flanner, born Indianapolis, 1892, who left for Paris with her female lover in 1922 for the amenities of Paris. She was going to become a fiction writer, and then she began writing a letter from Paris for the New Yorker magazine. She wrote the letter for 50 years, nearly 700 installments under the name Genet. And it's the birthday of L. Ron Hubbard, Lafayette Ronald Hubbard, born in Tilden, Nebraska, 1911, who in 1950 published Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, which promised that a therapeutic process called auditing could erase traces of traumatic experience and cure any physical or mental ailment. He founded the Church of Scientology in 1954, died of a stroke in 1986 on his ranch in California. Here's a poem for today by David Romtvedt entitled Still. The children are sleeping, and the cows and chickens are sleeping, and the grass itself is sleeping. The machines are off, and the neighbor's lights a half mile away are out, and the moon is hanging like a powdered face in a darkened room, and the snow is shining under stars the way we are shining here in our cold skins under warm quilts. We pull our shirts over our heads and toss them to the floor, and the only thing grotesque is the space through which we stumble each night. I roll to you and put my hand on your skin. You shiver and smile, cold but not too cold, some cold I like, and draw my hand closer. I pull it away and jam it in my armpit, and while I wait for the blood, I look at you, admire your face, your neck and breasts, your belly and thighs, the shadowy double of you thrown by candlelight to the wall. There is no season, no grass gone brown, no cold, and no one to say we are anything but beautiful, swimming together across the wide channel of night. A poem entitled Still by David Romtvedt from Some Church published by Milkweed Editions and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Friday, March 13th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. On the telephone with me now is Katie Brugman, one of the organizers of Saturday's Sham Jam at the Canvas. Welcome to the show, Katie.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so are you at the Canvas right now?
No, I'm actually not at the Canvas right now, but we will be there setting up all day tomorrow, and then the doors will open at 8 p.m.
Okay, so why don't you tell us all about Sham Jam? This is the 30th year, right?
Yeah, it's the 30th year, and it started out as something called Sham Rock and Roll. And 30 years ago, when Senator Johnny Ellis was a legislative staffer, he thought it might be fun to have a big party for the staffers to sort of celebrate halfway through the session. It's always right around St. Patrick's Day. And, yeah, it's just a lot of fun. This year, it's a fundraiser for the nonprofit The Canvas, which is downtown Juneau. I'm sure a lot of your listeners know about The Canvas. It's a great organization that benefits adults with disabilities that like to do art classes. So we're hoping to raise a lot of money for them. It's such a great cause.
And so I take it you guys alternate locations from year to year?
Yeah, for the past few years we've done it at The Canvas, and it's just a really great space to have a party. There's a big area for a dance floor and a bar, and this year we're going to have lots of great music. Because it's the 30th anniversary, we're doing music from the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and today, and our DJ has been lining up some hits over the past few weeks, and gotta say, it's going to be fabulous. He's found so many great songs that people are just going to really love.
I bet. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your capacity up on the Hill.
So this is my first session here, and I'm working for Senator Berta Gardner, who has been a hero of mine for a really long time. She does great work, and I'm just loving it. I've been living in Anchorage for a while, and I'm enjoying my time in Juneau. I have to say the city is so beautiful, and I love the mountains and the ocean, and it's just such a nice little town, so it's been great.
Okay, and then this party is sponsored by the Young Democrats, is that right?
It's put together by the Young Democrats. A lot of us are donating all of us are donating our time, and a lot of us are donating our personal funds to sort of help pay for stuff. So it's a team effort, and we're doing it just for the good of the cause and to give people a fun, thing to do halfway through the session.
Okay. Can you give us the details once more on the event tomorrow?
Sure. It's at 8 p.m. tomorrow night at the Canvas, which is 223 Seward Street, downtown Juneau. It's right around the Rockwell area. It's $30 at the door, 21 and over. We're going to have free drinks, pizza, door prizes. There's a costume contest, although if you don't want to dress up, that's totally cool, too. The party goes until about midnight.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun, and I bet you are busy up there, so I'm going to let you go. Katie
sure.
Brugman, anything else you want to add?
Well, I hope that you can come, and all your friends at KTOO, and we're hoping for a really good turnout.
Great, Katie. Thanks for your time.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Carlos Boozer. As an athlete, I had the blessing of having lots of great male role models. My father, my teachers, my coaches all encouraged me and taught me the fundamentals of the game, the same way I try to teach young people now. But as an Alaskan, I realized there's another more important skill I can model for young boys. It's respect. There's no place for violence against women in our state.
Together we can make a difference. Visit dps.alaska.gov/cdvsa.
This is Bird Note.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
Does this owl seem to be saying, "Who's awake? Me, too." Listen again.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
This nighttime hooter is the great horned owl, often heard during dark winter evenings and pre-dawn mornings. A pair of owls may call back and forth or overlap their hoots. The male's call is slightly lower in pitch. Can you pick it out? Chiefly nocturnal, the large 22-inch great horned owl is difficult to see. But even a good view won't show real horns, just two tufts of feathers that stick up from the top of the owl's head. These creatures hunt for prey at night, and they have exceptional vision. The bird perches quietly, its large yellow eyes watching for mice or other mammals up to the size of skunks. Like other nocturnal owls, the flight and contour feathers are frayed at the ends and very soft, allowing the owl to fly, hardly making a sound, to capture unsuspecting prey. The only sound we'll hear is the great horned owl's nighttime refrain. Who's awake? Me, too. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Friday, March 13th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. It's about 30 minutes past the hour, and I've been joined in the studio by biologist Karen Belivas. Welcome, Karen.
Thanks, Scott.
And also Michael Cohen, fellow biologist. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Scott.
It's nice to have you both here. You will be presenting tonight at the Friday Fireside Lecture out at the Mendenhall Visitor Center about bats. Interesting. Tell us about your work.
Yeah, that's right. We'll be doing kind of a team presentation here, and I'll be talking a little bit about the research that we've been doing on what bats, in particular little brown bats, do here in the Juneau area in the wintertime, and the difference in behavior may contribute to their resistance to a disease, fungal disease called white nose syndrome that's been devastating bat populations back east.
Okay. Little brown bats. Do we have other bats here in Southeast also, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, we do. We have six resident species of bats and then one that shows up in the fall and is probably maybe just migrating through.
Okay. Interesting. But little brown bats, are they sort of the most popular, if
most
you will?
Most common.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Most common. Thank you, Michael. So tell me about how you two gather data and about your field research. Michael?
Yeah, good question. That will be another part of the discussion tonight. I'll also present on our outreach that we do with citizen science in the communities. So we try to engage community members to work with us to answer some of our research objectives. So we have a lot of volunteers from these different communities, and we've been focusing on a driving survey, which has been part of a North America effort to try to get at the population of bats. And so we are going to ramp up that effort this year. We partnered with Gustavus and Haynes last year, and we want to expand that to more communities in Southeast this year. So I'll be excited to talk about that and hopefully gather some volunteers from Juneau.
Yeah, and car studies. Give us a little preview. I'm interested.
So a lot of our research, and Karen can talk more about this, is acoustic research. So we use special bat detectors and microphones that are mounted to the top of the car to be able to record bat calls from different areas. And so these driving surveys are able to tell us where bats are in the area as well as what species are there, and then also identify hot spots or like high bat activity areas.
Okay, and so these detectors, do bats use what's called echolocation? These detectors detect that? Wow, very cool. So this white nose syndrome you mentioned, Karen, it's a big deal down south, right?
It's a big deal back east. It started in a cave in New York in 2008, and it now has spread to all up and down the eastern seaboard, throughout the Appalachians, up into Quebec and Ontario, and as far west as Missouri and Minnesota. And it's estimated to have killed over 6 million bats.
And how does it affect them?
So it's a fungus that only grows on hibernating bats. So when bats go into hibernation, they'll lower their body temperature and they'll slow their breathing rate and metabolic rate. Everything slows down so they can conserve energy to make it through the winter because their insect prey isn't active. But that makes them very vulnerable because their immune system then is also suppressed. And so the fungus will grow, it attacks their tissues, and they end up arousing really very frequently and for longer than normal. And so they use up all their energy, and they starve to death before the insects become active again in the spring.
Wow. Very sad, really, I think. And you were telling me that our bats here in Alaska have a different sort of life cycle, or not life cycle, but...
They have a different hibernation behavior. So bats back east hibernate in caves and mines, and often in really large groups, like tens of thousands of bats in a single cave or mine system. And like you mentioned before, our bats are true Westerners. They are hibernating probably alone, maybe in small groups, in these rock roosts and in holes in the forest floor under root wads. And so it's good news for Western bats, I think. It's going to make it harder for the fungus to spread from bat to bat.
Well, I think I stole that from you. I think you wrote that they're true Westerners. I saw that in the description. So, Michael, tell us a little bit about what we can expect tonight.
Well, Karen's going to start off with describing this hibernation strategy that we think bats have here in Southeast. And then we're going to jump into more of the projects that we are involving community members in to try to gain more information about the many different kinds of bats that we have in Southeast.
Okay. Karen, in the first place, what drew you to studying bats?
It was the threat of white nose. You know, when we started the project in 2010, it just looked like white nose was unstoppable and that it was just going to steamroll right across the continent. And, you know, one of the hardest hit species is a little brown bat, and that's our most common and abundant. It's the only bat that's found in an interior in western Alaska. So if it wiped out little browns, it would wipe out bats from a large part of our state. And so there was a lot of concern.
Okay. How about you, Michael?
I was interested in the citizen science component to the job. I was new to bats 2 years ago, and now I feel like I've been in the bat world, and there's just so much to be done. There's so much research. There's questions that we want to be able to answer, and that takes a lot of effort from both our parts and also working with community members to gather data.
What would you say has surprised you most about all this time that you've been spending studying the bats?
Oh, there's
not to put you on the spot or anything.
They've surprised us in a lot of ways, I think. Finding hoary bats, you know, in migrating through Yakutat. I mean, the hibernation behavior has been very surprising to me, to just come up on a hole. It looks like a hole in the ground, and to think that bats are spending the winter there. Because I'm so used to thinking, as most people are, of bats hibernating in caves and mines. And so it was, really surprising when we found those first roosts.
How about
I found the first one. She was so excited when she came back.
Yeah, I think Karen will talk about tonight, but we do a lot of radio tagging, and that is basically our way of following bats around and seeing where they go and where they call home. And, man, it is pretty hard. The fall, they go to many different places. So we are constantly, every morning we wake up and we're wondering, you know, okay, are we going to go here, or is it to the next home that they call? You know, so we're constantly on our toes trying to track these guys around our community in Juneau and then see where they're going in the winter.
And how do you radio tag a bat?
I'll let Karen answer that one.
So after you've captured them, you basically trim a little bit of hair from between their shoulder blades and you use surgical glue to attach this tiny little transmitter. And it lasts. We have a very slow pulse rate, which makes it really agonizing to track. But it helps the batteries last longer, so we can get up to a month and a half on these tiny little transmitters.
And you find them while they're hibernating? Is that how you capture them?
No, that's the issue. We have to capture them in the fall, right, as they're preparing to go into hibernation. And then we just have to get lucky and try to track them. We go up in the plane at night, at sunset, and try to follow them in real time as they make their move to wherever they're going.
Wow. Wow. Very interesting.
It's challenging.
I have a lot more questions, but I'll save them for tonight. Maybe.
Great.
Tell us the details. When does it start? And I think 6:30, right?
6:30 and 8, yep.
Yeah, two shows. Sounds like a lot of fun. If somebody can't make it tonight but is interested in your research, or it sounds like there's a big community component, where can they go for more information?
They can go to our website, which is on the ADFNG. It's www.citizenscience.adfng.ak.gov. And they can sign up to be part of our listserv, and we will be able to update people with projects that we're working on as well as our research objectives.
Okay. Again, sounds very interesting. 6:30 and 8 o'clock tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Are we missing anything, Karen or Michael?
No, we're excited to see people tonight.
Great. Thanks for coming in, you two.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to A June Afternoon here on Friday, March 13th, 2015. It's about 20 minutes until the top of the hour, and I have been joined in the studio by John DeVore. Welcome, John. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You are the narrator, right, and a major part of this Red Bull movie, The Unwritables.
Yeah, you bet.
Yeah. And I just watched the trailer for this movie, and you're aerial athletes, and you're skiing with parachutes on, or maybe you're parachuting with skis on.
Right. Depends on the situation.
And I don't know, some might argue this might be one of the most extreme sports ever. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's all, take it all with a little bit of a grain of salt. Depends on where your mind's at. But yeah, it's, you know, it's just a sport that combines big mountain skiing with high-speed parachute flying and is really been able to allow us to open up terrain in the mountains that were otherwise inaccessible because there was no way to get out of them. And so, yeah, it's quite extreme. There's very little room for error. And being that we're pioneering this sport, there's a lot of unknowns that we're learning every time we go out. It's not like going to a ski resort where the run's predictable. Like you'll see in the movie tonight, if people are able to come out and watch it, that there are a lot of circumstances where we're flying through crevasses or off, you know, big blue ice walls or just through places that you cannot crash, you cannot stop, or it'd be a very bad situation. So I guess there's a lot of extreme in it.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You're born and raised Juneau, and how did you get into the sport?
Yeah, I grew up my whole life in Juneau. I was actually born in Colorado, but as a baby, my parents did the normal story of Juneau. They came up to visit and got hit with like 3 weeks of beautiful summer and moved up here when they had me and my sister, two little kids. So definitely from Juneau. And, yeah, I mean, growing up here was an amazing experience. Didn't know it at the time because you're just used to it. But after I started traveling down into the States and looking back and how much this town really shaped who I am today, that, you know, like everybody knows, if you don't get out and get after it in this town, you might go a little crazy. And so whether it was kayaking, skiing, scuba diving, you name it, if it was able to be done here, I touched it at least as a kid. And that really led to my adventurous spirit that led me to my career.
Okay. So tell us, most of this movie, is it filmed in the Alaska Range?
Yeah. To pay homage to the history of the sport of speed riding, we went to Chamonix, France. So the beginning of the film, we go there and talk with a couple of the early pioneers. So that's kind of the educational portion of the documentary. And then the bulk and the action and the really awesome cinematography is all done in the Alaska Range, in the Tordrillo Mountains, to be exact. And we were up there for 3 weeks from late April last year till like April 20th to May 8th, I think, was our window, a three-week window of just going off in God's country.
And tell me about how it evolved for you personally. Mm-hmm. Did you start skydiving, and how did it mix with the skiing you had done before?
Yeah. So after graduating high school, I chased down, you know, I made a jump, fell in love with the sport, so I chased it. And without burning too much radio time, it turned into a profession and was winning world meets and, you know, being at the top of the game, getting sponsors, and always in the back of my mind, I miss skiing like mad. I had to live in either California, Arizona, or Florida to be a professional skydiver, and, you know, you're not really skiing much there. So I always longed to find excuses to come home. And as the parachute started evolving and getting very high performance, we started flying them down mountains, but more as a skydiver point of view. And then a handful of people around the world were starting to combine it. A little bit of a paragliding influence where you'd launch off the mountain, but not on a big paraglide wing, on a really, we called it speed wings, the really small Ferrari parachutes. And then obviously it led to, this is way easier on skis, to now the challenge is how to stay on the ground more and ski, because the wings want to fly. So it's a very infant sport that's evolving, and we're just happy to be leading the charge.
There's this scene from the trailer that stuck in my mind of one of you just sort of popping off the top of, you know, these inaccessible mountains, or what
right,
you thought
one of those
were,
fingers, yeah.
Yeah, what you thought was inaccessible before, and now you can just fly to the top of it, ski it, and then fly to the next point.
Yeah, it's a, you feel kind of like a superhero in the sense that you're you know, skiing some line, you get a couple, 5, 6, 7, 8 turns, and then some cliff comes up, so you pop off it, and 1,000 feet to your left is another patch that looks awesome if you could set down to it. So that's your mission, is to soar over to it, set down, get some turns that you know that nobody's ever touched those locations, because it's a place that people can't go.
So you said superhero. Is it? I mean, yeah. Does it feel like you can fly when you're doing that?
Yeah, because you are. You are. I mean, with the experience that like myself and my team have, and you know, the professionals, it's all muscle memory. So at that point, we are flying. Our engines are out. We have no engines, but so we can't go up. But, yeah, we are 100% flying.
Wow. So the other sport that I've seen that looks kind of similar, is it called bat suit flying?
Yeah, officially wingsuiting.
Wingsuiting.
But a lot of people call it squirrel suiting because, like, flying squirrels.
How would you compare the danger level of these two sports?
I mean, to be just honest, they both have their dangers, but wingsuit flying is tenfold more dangerous because you cannot crash wingsuit flying. You're going the speeds that are just fatal every time. So it's just, if you're truly proximity flying really low to the ground where you couldn't pull a parachute even if you wanted to because you're too low, when you get yourself into those situations, it's you cannot crash. You can't mess up.
Have you tried that?
Yeah, I do. That's probably what I'm most known for almost. We just got done like good references. I do a lot of Hollywood stunt work too. So we flew the wingsuits in the Transformers 3 scene through all the buildings in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And just wrapped up filming. They're doing a remake of Point Break that'll come out in December. So about a year from now, in December. And we just did an epic long scene, wingsuit flying for that movie. And yeah, we do it a lot.
Sounds like a fun job.
Yeah, lucky, you know, I turn my passion to my profession, so I pinch myself every day.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the special screening tonight.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very proud to be back in my hometown and being able to offer this. You know, it's something I've always wanted to do in Alaska, and finally my dream came true. So The Unwritables has two screenings tonight at the Rockwell Ballroom, and the first one is at 6:30, and it is for all ages. So it's a great one for family to bring their kids out, for them to get inspiration, you know, because it's a very inspiring movie as well. And then there's the second showing is at 8:30, and that's for a 21 and older crowd because they'll open the bar up and it'll get a little bit more rowdy. But so whatever your flavor is, there's two screenings, and I hope to see everybody out because it's a very beautiful thing that showcases Alaska.
Yeah, a beautiful movie. One more question, John. What are you most proud of after this whole project, would you say?
You know, probably a combination of this movie. It's been a lifelong goal, or not lifelong goal since I've been a professional, is to be able to do this. I was lucky enough to come back 5 years ago and play back in the Juneau Ice Fields just a little bit, and that really lighted the fire for me to push hard for my sponsors and any outside help to do this grand project. So the fact that it actually happened, you know, I couldn't be prouder of the film itself. And then just because in 1991, I watched the original Point Break, and that inspired me to be a skydiver. And then I, 20 years later, doubled Johnny Utah in the new Point Break. So it's kind of a full circle for me. So those two things combined are definitely the highlights for me.
Great. Give us the details once more on tonight, please.
Yeah, at the Rockwell Ballroom right downtown, there's two screenings. One's at 6:30 p.m. for all ages, and the other one's at 8:30 p.m. for 21 and older.
John DeVore, the narrator and one of the main characters in The Unwritables, thanks for coming in today.
You betcha. Yeah, if anybody wants to check it out, just theunwritables.com. You can also get all that same information.
Sounds good, and I found the event on Facebook pretty easily,
yeah.
Too. Cool. Thanks, John.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
and KCSM, San Mateo, California.
Perseverance Theater brings Juno the Laugh Riot of the Year, Neil Simon's The Odd Couple. This Tony Award-winning comedy will keep you in stitches as we look back at these men from another era and ask ourselves, has that much really changed? The Odd Couple opens on March 6th and runs through March 29th. For more information and tickets, visit Hearthside Books, The Jack, ptalaska.org, or call 463-TIXS.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon today. I'll be your host again on Monday, and we'll talk with Judy Neary about a film series at the Pioneer Home. We'll talk with Sarah Luce and Darren Snyder about April Fowls and Foods Weekend. Artist Inari Kailanen will give us a preview of her upcoming class on color theory. And we'll talk with Shelley Wright about this week's Southeast Conference Mid-Session Summit. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more on Monday on a Juno Afternoon, live at 3 here on KTOO and repeated at 4 on KRNN and online at KTOO.org. The weather tonight, numerous snow showers mixed with rain in the evening, snow accumulation 1 to 3 inches, lows around 29. Saturday, numerous snow showers, snow accumulation 1 to 3 inches, highs around 33. Sunday, mostly cloudy, chance of rain and snow. And Monday, mostly cloudy, chance of rain and snow, highs around 40. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.